everyone is safe and staying healthy and through today. It's kind of a nice respite from some of the COVID communications. Although Dan and I were scheduled to do this, I think right as everything broke, so was like confused about actually at this point. But interestingly, the timing I think is really good. So Dan has been a part of the fintech revolution since its inception. He advises some of the biggest brands in the space, including Morgan Stanley, Bloomberg, Goldman Sachs. He's written this great new book, which was just published, called Game Hackers, about disruptive fintech, what it is, why it emerged, and who some of the players are. And interestingly, it really started to emerge during the last big crisis we had, the global financial crisis. So this was just published as the financial markets were again disrupted by the coronavirus. So I think we'll have a real interesting conversation about some of the parallels between then and now and what the future could hold. I first met Dan at the Page Spring Seminar last year. It was my first spring seminar. I was looking forward to this year, so we will join it virtually. But Vanguard's been working with his firm Vested, which is an integrated communication firm that partners with top fintech and financial companies. And then we're working with one of Vested's clients to implement blockchain technology, which will help improve our investment management capabilities. So I'm glad that this all kind of came full circle. Dan's natural curiosity about all things related to finance and his unique viewpoint as really an insider in the financial industry have really positioned him to be an authority on the beginnings of the fintech revolution. He's been watching the industry since its inception and has chronicled its major events from the day when Apple launched its app store to the Winklevoss trend becoming key players in Bitcoin and beyond. And he tells some fantastic stories in his book. He's a regular columnist for Forbes, Market Media, Cointelegraph, has appeared on Cheddar, FinTech TV, Asset TV, and Bright Talk's Focus on Fitness, Focus on FinTech series. And he's the publication insiders in the podcast, and so Daniel is also spending time juggling the world of financial communications while quarantining with his wife, Erin, and his two daughters, Carla and Eleanor, in Brooklyn. So thanks for making the time today, Dan.
Thanks for having me, and I hope everyone is staying well, like you said. I've been accused of many things, but fitness was never one of them. Finance, unfortunately, is my forte, not fitness. I'd have had a different life, especially not right now.
Yeah, especially for all.
Bread baking and eating. I'm an expert in.
So, well, we can talk a lot about your area of expertise. Great book. I have this actually, to be honest, it was the first book I've ever read on a Kindle. I really prefer paper, so I'm looking at that jealously, but it was great to read on my Kindle. And in the book, you really suggested that this big, massive disruption of the global financial crisis was catalyst to some of the greatest innovations in the fintech space. Can you talk a little bit about why you think that was so and maybe what that foretells for the crisis we're going through right at the moment?
Yeah, great question. So when we started writing the book, you know, we really looked at 2008 as a pivotal moment. Obviously, for those of us in finance, when we think about 2008, the first thing that comes to mind is most impactfully Lehman Brothers. And I was there. I stood outside the Lehman building and watched the lights go off. That's what I think about when I think of it. An entire different cohort in this country that goes, yes, 2008, that was when the App Store launched. That was when Facebook had customers. You know, that was when Instagram launched. A bunch of stuff that actually came about in 2008. This confluence of two unrelated factors. But there were two things really happening. If you think about the banks, if you'd have asked the bank to point to their innovation before 2008, and I'll try and say this in a way that doesn't sound insulting, they would point to primarily the capital markets group of their bank. They would have said, we're doing some amazing innovations over here in capital markets. Let me tell you about it. We've got these technologists. They're doing super low latency trading. We're doing co-location. We're doing incredible trading, and we've built these very complex asset classes and derivative structures that really enable us to defray risk in a really innovative way. That's what innovation meant to a bank before 2008, and also they were extending credit. You know, these ever complex constructions were enabling them, the way that we saw it, enabling them to extend credit to a lower percent of the lower 50% of the market. So in 2008, you have the financial crisis, and banks learned two lessons from the financial crisis. And of course, this is a gross generalization, but they learned two lessons. One was innovation is bad. We let the technologists run our business, and we didn't fully understand what they were doing. And that led us into all kinds of problems. And we are now dealing with regulators up the wazoo. And extending credit is bad. We got punished for doing what we were told to do. In the early 2000s, before that, in the Clinton administration, there was a big push for us to extend credit into communities that hadn't had it before. We did what we were told. And look, now we're being punished for it. So innovation was bad. Extending credit was bad. So they withdrew from both of those things, became dirty words in 2008. At the exact same moment, you have this explosion of technology. Facebook hits 100 million customers. The App Store launches. People learn how to do one thing very, very well. And so they realized two things. One was innovation is great, and there are these new ecosystems like the App Store on which we can innovate. And by the way, we can serve the lower 50% of the market and make money at it. Look at Google, look at Facebook, look at Amazon. They're all coming into their own in 2008. And so the promise of ubiquity first, revenue later, starts to come to the fore. So you have a crisis with two different views of the same moment in time, opposing views of the same moment in time. And so the vacuum that's left by the banks is the space into which the fintechs that we cover in this book, people that we call the money hackers, you know, walk in. It's greenfield pastures for them.
So effectively, the banks created some friction. They made it more difficult after that to get loans, and that opened the door for come in and try to reduce that friction. Because you spend a lot of time talking about, you know, friction. Some of the things that are also catalysts is, you know, finding the problem and trying to reduce the friction. And a lot of the innovators profile kind of have these aha moments where they recognize that there's something broken that they're trying to do themselves, and they can probably solve for that.
Yeah, they understood. So, we, I think, as communicators, understand instinctively things like customer journey, user experience, beauty, right? Think about a concept like beauty, right? Attractiveness. It's not something that banks were known for, but it's something that Steve Jobs and Apple was known for, right? Bringing beauty into the world through products, simplicity of design, user experience, customer journey. We as communicators, marketers, storytellers kind of understand these concepts better than probably anybody else in our institutions. You know, but there was an entire cohort of people who kind of clued into that and applied it to finance. So whether you call it friction reduction or whether you call it, you know, user experience or customer journey, you know, that's really what these technologists understood. They're kind of marketers, actually. They're very good. They're very good marketers. The technology itself was not particularly revolutionary. There's a few things. If we look at like the creation of blockchain technology, that are kind of out there, maybe AI, there's some AI now that is kind of very whiz bang, quantum computing. But most of the stuff that we cover in this book, the fintechs that we're talking about, is very simple stuff. It's actually very simple. And it runs mostly on banking rails, platforms like Plaid and Yodlee, enabled an ecosystem on which fintechs could build. And they're not doing anything very clever from a technology perspective. It's mostly all the things that we as communicators dabble in: marketing, you know, brand, the emotional response that you elicit from your customers. So in many ways, they're kind of marketers first, technologists second.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you early start with the story of Venmo, which is one of my particular favorites, because I remember the whole cycle of, you know, through the drive-through and putting your check in the slot, and the vacuum sucks it up, and out comes some cash. So then snapping my Mac, which kids get that reference anymore. And now I go out for drinks and I send some beer emojis and some money through Venmo to friends. Ultimately, at the end of the day, for taco emojis. It was sort of an ease of use, but it's also a lot of fun to do it. So, and of course, you know, the founders are Philly based, so I'm biased since we are out in Philadelphia. Maybe talk a little bit about what made that particular technology so successful. because I think it does touch on all of these things that really are communication focused.
One of the things you find when you read the book and that particular story is that Venmo wasn't particularly successful to start with. It was actually, it had, as we say in the book, it had 2,000 users and as many dollars in the bank. And it was the discovery brought by Braintree, and then you know, basically PayPal, pulling Venmo into the PayPal ecosystem that really saved it and blew it out. So one of the lessons, of course, is that for every, I would just throw out that for every kind of whiz bang innovative technology that exists, there is also a story of a lot of grit and a lot of, it wasn't an overnight success. Barely anything that we talk about in here is an overnight success. It involves a lot of what I call plumbing. If you look at the story of Yodlee that we have in here, the story of like World Remit, most of it is people hardwiring the financial services ecosystem. And working unbelievably hard. I'm personally not a huge believer that the social part of Venmo is a killer app. Just as a, and this probably reflects the fact that I'm like a Gen Xer. I'm not quite young enough to, I'm not quite young enough to really get on the whole, social money bandwagon. Mm-hmm. I really believe that a huge amount of their success was rather like with the lending. This was just the space that the banks had vacated. If you think about Zelle, of course, which many of the people on this call may be members of that Zelle network. When did that launch? 3 years ago? And before that, unless we used Venmo, it was like, do you have QuickPay, Chase QuickPay? Oh, no, I'm with Bank of America. Okay, well, now what are we going to... So Venmo was really the only option. I think Zelle will be interesting to see whether that social component is genuinely sticky enough.
You mentioned they don't really have it. It actually allows you to have some degree of transparency, of opacity, if you don't really want people to know that you're out having beers and talking.
So we conducted a millennial money study a couple of years ago. One of the really interesting things that came out from that, I grew up in a world where privacy and security were the same thing. But in our millennial money study, they rated privacy the least important thing and security the most important. So they see privacy and security as very distinct in a way that, for me, it was the same thing.
Yeah, interesting. And I have a Gen Zer, so shares everything.
Right.
They don't complete. Yeah. So let's go back. I know it's really asking you to prognosticate, but so we've just gone through, or we're in the middle of a pandemic. The financial markets I haven't actually looked today, but obviously yesterday was a bad day. Earlier, we had a 39% drop of the S&P. What do you think that this will have a similar type of effect on future innovation in the fintech space? Are you already seeing things? What are the kind of frictions and problems that you're seeing emerge from this? The ones I thought of, even just people, small businesses trying to get money, been really difficult, and it's probably going to be done there. But how do you think that this will affect innovation in the fintech space going forward?
Yeah, well, there's certainly friction. You guys couldn't hear me for a little bit. So there's, friction to solve with stuff like that. And that is a good example, actually, right? So crises drive behavioral change. So Zoom, which we're on, entered 2020 with 10 million customers. Today it has 250 million users. So crises drive technology adoption. The other thing that crises do is they drive innovators. They create innovators. And there's a reason for it. You wouldn't think it. You'd be like, why did you? And so that was a question I kept asking. So if you look at Betterment, founded in 2008, Lending Club, founded in 2008, Credit Karma, founded in 2008, right next, they stood, Lending Club and Credit Karma stood next to each other at a financial conference called Finovate at little tiny desks. And I kept asking these guys, why did you start a business in 2008? Like, that would seem like the worst time to build a lending company or a robo-advisor. And so superficially, it seems like a crazy time to do it. But actually, if you really consider what happens before a crisis, the opportunity cost equation for starting something is very high. John Stein was working at McKinsey and getting paid a lot of money before the crisis. So to leave your very well-paid job at the height of a market, you have to leave a lot of money on the table. You also have to be very, very sure that what you're going to do is going to be successful. And by the way, when you choose to start your initiative, everything is very expensive. Labor costs are very, very high. Technology costs are very high. Real estate costs are very high. So this is starting a company in December 2019. That's what that reality would have been. You'd have had to leave a very well-paying job, and you'd have to pay for things at their very most premium. If you look at what happened in the last 3 weeks or 6 weeks, you know, you may not have a job anymore, right? You may have lost the job, or you may have just graduated college with no hope of a job. Also, things just got very, very cheap. I was reading a thing about real estate, right? So the Manhattan real estate market, it may be forever changed, as I think the three biggest firms in the three biggest real estate owners in Manhattan are Citi, Morgan Stanley, and Bank of America, or JP Morgan. And all three have said they may not return. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what does that do to the cost of real estate? Now you're an entrepreneur, everything just got suddenly much, much cheaper. Right. So the cost-benefit analysis flips in a crisis, which is why you see innovation. So several things are happening at the same time in a crisis. One is behavior is changing. Needs are changing, and then it's a much richer environment for entrepreneurs if they can attract the investment capital.
Yeah, it's sort of all three of those things, but then they also have to. I mean, so much of this to me is, you know, both a combination of brilliance and luck, because they also have to key into just the right trend. So you brought up Betterment, and Betterment's close to our hearts here at Vanguard, because founder John Stein was, I wouldn't call it friends, but friendly with our founder, Jack Bogle, and sort of a real student of indexing and low cost. And you know, I think maybe there were some questions at that time about whether people would actually trust a AI and a computer to give them financial advice. Even at Vanguard, we have what we would call virtual advice. We have advisors that only met with you on a Zoom meeting. That was novel back then and hard to sell. I think obviously it'll be much more accepted today. But for him, and that's a real risk, that you might have cheap labor, you might have a great idea, you might have cheap real estate, but you know, is the marketplace ready for something like that? Can you talk a little bit about maybe how he thought about that?
Sure. And by the way, you can get in trouble for being too early as well as too late, right? So that's what you're saying. I mean, the landscape is filled with people who created YouTube a year too early, or MySpace, you know, not Facebook. So you know, you're right to say luck and timing plays a huge role in it. You know, I think as John saw it, you know, the subtitle of my book is "The Money Hackers: How a Group of Misfits Took on Wall Street and Changed Finance Forever." And I think every one of the people that I interviewed, and I did over 150 interviews for the book, they are misfits in their own way. John was not interested in finance. He wasn't a finance bro. He wasn't a finance guy. And I think that's what enabled him. And that's another feature of all these folks, is they weren't, if you're inculcated in an industry, you can only think incrementally, right? You only think about marginal improvements if you've lived inside something for forever. But if you don't have any dog in the fight, you just walk into it and you can completely reimagine it, because you haven't had 20 years of someone telling you that's the way we've always done it. You know, Robert Kennedy said some men look at the world the way it is and they ask why. You know, I think about the way it could be and I ask why not. You know, and the history of entrepreneurship has this kind of same resonant thing. Like Steve Jobs says, never ask your customers. You know, customers don't know what you want, what they want, until you show it to them. Henry Ford said, if I'd asked my customers, I'd have built a faster horse. You know, there's this tension between innovators who iterate inside organizations and make incremental improvements, which is very important, and then those people who just, you know, walk in from the outside and they're like, what? And you see that with Lending Club, you know, with Renaud Laplanche. She's like, why am I by the way, is my audio doing any better, or is it still? It's better now. Okay, fine.
Yeah, you're great.
Okay, good. So you see that, you know, Renaud Laplanche got a bill from the bank at the same time as he got a statement from his bank, and he's like, wait, I lend you money at this percent, and I borrow money from you at this percent. Why? And he's coming at it from an outsider who says infrastructure. Infrastructure is the reason for that spread. What if I delivered something with no infrastructure? And John had the same view. I don't think he was thinking, oh, well, you know, will people ever give up their financial advisors? That wasn't how he thought about it. He thought about it like a McKinsey consultant. He just came at it and he was like, why are we, you know, essentially we're charging 100 basis points to pick stocks when we already know the story of passive investing. We know how this story ends. We know that long term it's going to perform better. And by the way, you know, talk about the way that crises break shibboleths, break people's thinking. How much did we hear before this crisis that we were just waiting for this crisis for passive investing to go away? Right? That was the narrative that many people told us.
Right. Managers always know just when to get out and just when to get in.
Yeah, that hasn't been proven to be true. So what this crisis shows us is that passive investing is a secular trend. It's just a long arc of history, right? So, you know, I think he saw that, and just coming at it from an outsider's perspective, he's like, well, what if we took away the infrastructure? The infrastructure being, you know, RIAs and advisors and wealth managers and that. And that isn't to suggest that those people don't have an important role to play in finance, but just coming at it from an outsider's perspective, he said, well, what if we took it away? And if you're a wealth manager, you would never think, what if I made myself obsolete? Like, no. You know, you cannot, no one will ever ideate that. Like, what if I didn't exist tomorrow? Like, it's very hard to do from the inside. It's very easy to do from the outside. And that is, you know, pretty much everyone in this book was coming at it from that outsider perspective.
One of the challenges, I think, one of the handicaps that insiders have, especially in a regulated industry like banking and asset management, is you think, the regulators would never let us do something like that. I mean, you touched on Lending Club, and I think there's a big theme in that story. You know, certainly once we come through things like the GFC, and I'm sure coming out of this, usually there's a lot of finger pointing and then a lot of regulation put in place. I mean, do you actually think maybe there's some downsides to any of this type of innovation? I mean, if they're not thinking in the same mindset that maybe we have, which is, you know, what would it be allowable, permissible? They can do some new things, but, you know, those regulations are also there for certain reasons. So what, I mean, are there any risks or downsides to these types of innovations? And do you think any of it contributed to any of the volatility we see now on Wall Street?
Yeah, I saw that question when you sent it to me, Rebecca. You know, when in 2008, right, electronic trading comprised, what, 4% of the market. Today it's 24%, right? You want to talk about, look at like Aladdin. BlackRock's Aladdin. You want to talk about concentration risk? I don't know is the answer. I'm not a finance expert. I just play one on TV. I'm a PR guy. I'm really an English and French literature guy who kind of pretends to know finance. So I couldn't tell you that the exponential growth in electronic trading has led to volatility. It's perfectly possible. It's also perfectly possible we're in a 100-year pandemic. So volatility is to be expected, sort of buckle up. What I can tell you, I think this interesting tension between sort of regulation, innovation is a fascinating one. And I think banks for too long relied on regulation as a competitive moat. The reality is banks are very sticky. They're really hard to get in and out of, and they know it. And like, I'll just say something, with the greatest respect to Wells Fargo, and I've got one of my friends, you know, leads comms at Wells Fargo, Hannah. If Wells Fargo was a brand of a medicine that you had to go and pick up at the store, like a Tylenol, you know, they would be out of business. That crisis would have done them in. It is literally the stickiness and the regulatory moat that protects so many financial brands. And one view of it is it stifles innovation. Another view is it's health and wealth, and we can't afford to mess around with these things. And listen, there's stories on the other side too. But, Robinhood, which is a fintech trading app, crashed, cost investors billions of dollars because they couldn't exit their positions exactly when the market was getting getting volatile. So there's something to be really said for this institutional, robust, resilient, heavily regulated kind of Soviet style infrastructure that just cannot break. And I just think it's about trying to get that balance right between, not throttling the sandboxes and the innovation. But also making sure that we don't go to the Wild West and let people lose a lot of money, because money is, really important to people. So, I think that frankly, the US does a very bad job of it, in part because we have a regulatory spaghetti junction with literally 100 financial regulators and self-regulators, SEC, CFTC, FINRA, OCC, 50 state regulators if you want a bank license. If you look at the UK, which just has the FCA, it's much easier to get a single answer on, where do I stand with a bank license? I mean, it's impossible to get a bank license in the US. It's impossible, which is why you see so many of these neobanks like Chime, N26, Monzo, Revolut, partnering up with existing banks. It's much easier in Europe to do something new and get your own banking license. So I don't have a definitive position on regulation. I think it's good in a way, stifles innovation in a way. I think banks sometimes, we give banks a hard time when actually they have a real fiduciary responsibility and they care a great deal. And then sometimes I think, they just, from when mighty oak trees fall and acorns bloom or something, you need to get the big ones out of the way to let the innovation grow.
Oh, that's a great image. I mean, I would expect, maybe it's more service than anything else, but banks and maybe big investment firms saying, well, we need to disrupt ourselves. There is a recognition that these things existed. We need to just really challenge ourselves to get over some of the hurdles that you've described. Do you see this actually happening? Has it worked? I mean, I think Dell was sort of an attempt at that.
Absolutely, and it's going to be great. And in many ways, right, the banks have the ability to sit back and see what works. So, and I address this in the book. There's a chapter in the book called The Empire Strikes Back, which is about when, were they slow or were they just on time, right? Because what's going to happen right now is this next crisis is going to challenge a lot of those VC-funded companies. If you haven't turned a profit yet, you could really be put under pressure by your investors to consolidate or get acquired. And the banks could be well positioned to actually buy up a lot of those fintechs. Goldman has been one of the banks that has done that, with Marcus and then Clarity Money, who we talk about in the book, to try and build a fintech offering for themselves for the mass market. So it's hard to say. Some of the banks, do what I would call innovation theater. And again, I'm very friendly with Matt Ward and the team over at HSBC, but I also do give them a little bit of a hard time in the book over Pepper the robot. If you guys have seen Pepper the robot, to me, I love HSBC with the greatest respect. That's not where I would throw, my innovation dollars. It's not where I would show people, look, we're innovative. To me, that little dancing robot in the lobby of a bank branch at a time when we can't get into bank branches strikes me as the definition of innovation theater. It's not really material, I think HSBC did themselves a disservice, because actually, if you look under the hood, they're also doing some really interesting things with blockchain. They're also doing some things with international payments and stuff that's not as shiny, but I think more meaningful. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there were banks that did exactly what you're describing. So one of my favorite chapters in this, or characters in this, is Margaret Keane, who is the CEO of Synchrony Bank, which was GE Capital, sort of the very definition of a big stodgy financial institution. And she goes out in 2008. I talked at the beginning about this inflection moment. It's really a story of two coasts, the East Coast and the West Coast in 2008. So she sort of picks herself up and goes on a fact-finding mission in 2008. And she goes to the offices of Splunk, the development group, and she said, you know, the mother in her was like disgusted at the office with this frat bro. She said she wanted to clean up their offices. All their stuff was around. It smelled like sneakers, you know. But she said what she noticed when she got past that kind of initial disgust was a group of developers doing things completely different from the way that she had a development team operating. So she had 4,000 developers. But what these kids were doing with their Scrum development and their Lean and their development sprints was so revolutionary, she decided to take that and bring it back. And she carved out this team of her best developers. And she said, you don't do legacy infrastructure anymore. You don't look after the keeping going, that incremental thinking that we're talking about. Forget incrementalism. You're going to operate as if you just graduated college. And if day one of the recession and you are Steve Jobs or Microsoft or any of these other companies that actually started in a recession, and that moonshot group or that Project X group or that Skunk Works group, that's what became Synchronous Financial. So, you know, it's doable. But you have to have the institutional will to pull it off.
Yeah, and humility to admit you might be doing things the wrong way. So,
correct.
So you mentioned, you know, we talked about banks maybe being able to do this, but you know, we recently did a partnership with Ant Financial in China, and it's just so impressive to me how the platforms, because it's really Alibaba and then Tencent also has banking and finance. It's so impressive how those platforms have become major financial players. How do you think about this for the future of Amazon? Or, I mean, Facebook has payments now, Google has payments, but where do you think the big platform providers here play a role in all of this?
I think it's very interesting. And that we kept asking that of people in the book, and they had different opinions. Some people said, why would you want to get into this market? You do what you do very well. There's a long history, actually, of people. It actually goes back to GE Financial. GE Financial was from the 20s to help you finance dishwashers and things like that. Actually, this play of retail and banking is not new. Ford got into financing. And if we remember, Sears bought, is it Dean Witter? They bought an advisory shop.
Yeah, forgot about that.
So there is actually a long legacy of this, you know, retail kind of, if we think about Amazon, kind of dipping their toe into the financial, you know, world. And most of the time, it doesn't work out very well. And the true diehard financial people would say that's because we've got the regulatory moat, and that's because you don't understand, and you want to run fast and break things, and we take care of people. But I think technology, the sort of technology that we have today, really challenges that assumption. And you are not wrong, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, you know, to think that you look at China, where really, a WeChat is a single app that does everything, right? It's a financial app. It's a ride-hailing app, right? So the big technology platforms, they have something that the banks don't have, which is our attention. And this is why, by the way, I am not a technologist. So, you know, for those who are on this call, I hope you realize that really I'm saying the word technology. It's really marketing. It's marketing and mindshare and all the stuff that we as PR people and comms people deal in. That's why I wrote the book. That's why I found it so fascinating, because it's not about payment gateways. It's about capturing mindshare. So the banks have something that technology companies don't have, which is the ultimate data about intent. You know, Facebook can intuit what we might be interested in by the ads that we click on Instagram. But a bank really knows us. I always say, don't tell me what you believe in, tell me what you spend money on. You know, and it's like, that is the ultimate. That is, so we're into some sort of real sort of Westworld stuff here for a second, but it is, what you spend money on is the ultimate indicator of data, right? So if you're at Google, sorry?
Amazon knows what we spend money on, for sure.
And Amazon knows what we spend money on. Google and Facebook don't. And I mean, look, if you were going to pick a company that was going to run everything as the single monopoly organization, you'd say it was Amazon, right? You just use it. So, you know, the banks have that data. And and the techs want it. The techs have our attention, and the banks want it. So there is going to be a convergence, and Google, Facebook, and of course Amazon are incredibly well positioned. If Amazon tomorrow, Amazon is already offering financing for its vendors on the platform. So in many ways, Amazon is already into this in the same way that Google has check-in, Apple has Apple Pay, and then the new card with Goldman. You know, Facebook has payments, and it's also still hanging on to its Libra, co-Libra idea. Amazon, if Amazon tomorrow decided to offer fractional financing, like a Bread Finance or something, they could feasibly become one of the largest financial institutions overnight. It should keep every financial institution awake at night.
Yeah. Even more relevant.
Do they want to be? Yeah, and several of the people I spoke to, sort of, so Blythe Masters, who created Digital Asset, sort of framed it. Her experience, of course, is with regulation, a lot of it, because she was the poster child for everything in 2008. And so she sort of talks about a tale of regulation wherein, really we had 10 years of bank regulation, and that's really starting to ease. Just as the technology, the focus on big tech is going up, the tech lash is driven, so maybe this is an interesting time for tech to move into banking, because it's a sort of regulatory arbitrage play.
That's true. I'm proud about that. Well, so you mentioned the Libra. I do a lot of webcasts for our clients. We just did one and had nearly 30,000 people watch live. And even in crises like this, one of the biggest questions is always around Bitcoin. When is Vanguard starting a Bitcoin fund, which we are not? So Libra, other cryptocurrencies, I mean, how important do you think those are to the future? There's been obviously a lot of price volatility there. And then maybe you touched on blockchain a little bit, but I mean, that is really the underlying technology, the underlying innovation. And, we're obviously working together with a client on using blockchain for many things. So maybe you could talk a little bit about future blockchain here.
Cool. So I've been wrong about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency every step of the way. So it will not die. In fact, it's doing the opposite of dying and thriving, I guess. We got this halving coming up, and it was recently at 10, and then it dropped. And there's some conspiracy theories about why it dropped, but basically, it sort of it persists. Crypto as a concept persists, and it certainly has its applications. And I won't sort of get into the anarcho-syndicalist kind of views of central banking and decentralization. I'm obviously more interested, I think, in the blockchain technology that underpins it. I think that has, massive potential from two views. One is, of course, to, revolutionize, and then also just to make things more efficient inside financial services. The irony of blockchain is it was created in 2008 specifically for the purpose of disintermediating financial institutions, right? So the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper includes references to the financial crisis as a big sort of shout out to say, okay, these banks can't be trusted to run the financial system. We need a decentralized model to do it. But the groups that have been most interested in adopting blockchain have been the intermediaries. So in the exchanges, if you look at the Australian Stock Exchange, the DTCC, which is a client of mine, are all interested in blockchain, because in addition to having an origin in kind of stick it to the man, tear down the central, decentralize everything, blockchain or distributed ledger technology has fundamental efficiencies that can be utilized by established financial institutions. And that's what Blythe Masters did when she moved from JP Morgan to Digital Asset, was sort of champion this idea of blockchain, blockchain for grown-ups. If you like, not this kind of weird sort of Bitcoin-y kind of thing, but rather actually just as a very efficient piece of technology that could help reduce costs inside financial services companies. I think that's going to continue to, that's going to continue to be the application, I think, of blockchain technology is actually by the people it was designed to get rid of, as an efficiency tool.
Mm-hmm.